So it gives me great pleasure to announce our next speaker, who many of you have probably heard him. You've seen him on EWTN or on Ave Maria Radio. Excuse me while I get my glasses. This is Professor Roy Schumann. And Roy is an AMU here at Auburn University. He's an adjunct professor of theology. And his lovely wife also is a professor here, and she's taught several of my children here. And Professor Roy Schumann was born Jewish and received his religious education with prominent rabbis and contemporary American Jewry. While teaching at Harvard, he was given the grace of supernatural experiences that resulted in his conversion, after which he became active in Catholic evangelization. In 2003, his first book, Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History, was published by Ignatius Press and became a surprise bestseller. Now, I'm reading this author, but I don't think it was a surprise to Roy Schumann that it was a bestseller. I think maybe his publisher was surprised. Professor Schumann has become a popular guest on many EWTN shows, including EWTN Live with Father Pacwa, The Journey Home, The Carpenter Shop, Faith and Family, and Bookmark. A sought-after speaker at parishes, conferences, and retreats throughout the U.S., Canada, Europe, and South America, we are delighted to have him present Jewish Mother, Jewish Son. Please, a warm welcome to Professor Roy Schumann.
Okay.
It's on your shirt.
It's on my. Oh, hey. I'm Jewish. It couldn't have been me. I got to tell this joke. I hope I'm forgiven for it. What's the cheer of the Jewish football team? Get that quarterback. Anyway. So when you said I was dropping money, I got scared for a moment. Let me correct that comment. The fact that Salvation is from the Jews, that my first book was a bestseller, was a surprise to me, because I had no idea the resonance that Jewish identity has and that Judaism has with cradle Catholics. But I'll talk more about that tomorrow. Tomorrow my talk will be more centered. Tomorrow's talk is titled Why the Blessed Virgin Mary Had to Be Jewish. So it's more centered around the relationship intrinsically between Judaism and the Catholic faith and the Catholic Church. Today's talk is more centered around my witness testimony. So I'll just launch into that, which is also very centered around the Blessed Virgin Mary. So let me just begin at the beginning. As was mentioned, I was born Jewish and raised Jewish. I consider myself still Jewish. In fact, more Jewish than ever. I like to say that if I was Jewish before I became a follower of the Jewish Messiah, how did I stop being Jewish by becoming a follower of the Jewish Messiah? It doesn't make any sense. It should make me more Jewish than ever. The only difference is I went from being a Jew who was wrong about who Jesus was to a Jew who's right about who Jesus was. And if Jews are supposed to be right about everything, that too should make me more Jewish than ever. So anyway, my parents were both German Jewish Holocaust refugees. They were both born and raised in Germany. My father got out right after Hitler came to power. There was a short period when he was actually encouraging Jews to leave as long as they left everything behind, and he escaped as a young man then, or fled as a young man then. My mother's family was less fortunate. They fled to France, to Paris, but of course Paris fell to the Nazis also, and she was actually arrested by the Gestapo and put on the train to a concentration camp, but she escaped from the train and made it to the United States, where my parents met and married and where I was born. My whole world was Jewish growing up. In those days, there was more separation anyway, all my parents' friends were Jewish, all my friends were Jewish, my whole world was Jewish. I was quite devout and went to Jewish religious education from the beginning of my school years until I went to college alongside secular education. And you know, my whole identity was Jewish, and my relationship to God, I couldn't imagine any other form of a relationship to God. And in my late high school years, I became even more kind of fervently Jewish, and I became the follower of a Hasidic rabbi. You know, the Hasids with the ear curls and the long black coats and so forth. And I became his disciple and actually lived with him and traveled with him in Israel the summer between high school and college. And toyed with the idea of not coming back to the United States and beginning college in the fall, but essentially entering Jewish religious life in Israel. But I didn't do that. I came back. I'm distracting myself a little bit because I feel like I'm kind of hiding behind this big podium like I'm Ted Kennedy or something, but I can't take the microphone with me, so I guess I have no choice. Anyway, I came back to the United States. I began university. I went to MIT. I lost my faith, my Jewish faith at MIT, for two reasons. One was under the influence of the pseudoscientific worldview. Religion is just a medieval superstition. Science has all the answers. Anything that science doesn't have the answers to today, it will have in 5 years and so forth. This is actually a pseudoscientific view. It's not a scientific view. It's the opposite of a scientific view. Because the essence of science is you start with the evidence, you start with the facts, and you develop a hypothesis that suits the facts. And if that hypothesis doesn't fit the facts, you throw away that hypothesis, and you have to come up with a new theory to fit the facts. Now, in fact, all of the facts, all of the evidence is for the faith in general, and for the Catholic faith in particular. We're going to have more talks this weekend about that, but there's plenty of essentially scientific evidence that supports the Catholic faith. You have the Eucharistic miracles that are surrounding the room. You have the miracle at Fatima, where the sun danced in the sky and fell to the earth and was seen by 70 to 100,000 people, including atheists and agnostics and so forth. You have the medical miracles at Lourdes, and for a medical miracle at Lourdes to be approved by the medical board there as a certified miracle, there has to be physical documented proof of the condition before the healing, of the healing after the healing. It has to be virtually instantaneous. It has to be unreversed. It has to have no natural explanation and so forth. There's tons of actual scientific evidence for the faith. So in fact, this view that somehow the faith is unscientific is really a very unscientific view in itself. G.K. Chesterton has a quote, rightly or wrongly, those who believe in miracles believe in them on the basis of the evidence. And rightly or wrongly, those who disbelieve in miracles refuse to believe in them on the basis of faith, right? So think about that for a moment. But anyway, but nonetheless, I lost my faith at MIT under the influence of that pseudoscientific worldview. And by the time I got out of MIT, I was essentially atheist. I went on to Harvard Business School. I did well enough there that I was invited back to join the faculty. So I found myself a newly minted professor of marketing at Harvard Business School at the ripe old age of 29. And that's really where my witness testimony begins. Because what had been going on was that all my life, since I was a small child, I felt there has to be a real meaning and purpose to life. And someday when I'm older, I'll come into the real meaning and purpose of life. And as a child, I thought that would come from entering into a personal relationship with God, which I honestly thought would happen at my bar mitzvah. Now, the bar mitzvah is a religious ceremony when the boy is 13. It's pretty parallel to the Catholic confirmation. There's a ceremony in the synagogue, and the child enters religious adulthood. And I honestly believe that at my bar mitzvah, the veil would drop, and I would enter into a personal relationship with God. And when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days of my childhood. Then pretty soon, I decided the real meaning and purpose of life would come when I got a driver's license. Or when I got a girlfriend, or when I left home to begin college, or when I began my career, and so forth. But here I was already a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School, already more successful in a worldly sense than I ever expected to be, but life still had no meaning or purpose. But the difference being, at this point, there was nothing I could look forward to any longer that I could hope would give life meaning, because I wasn't about to be more successful than I already was. I had never expected to be anything like that. So at that point, the bottom fell out of my world. There was nothing to live for and no hope that something would emerge that would give life meaning. And I fell into the deepest despair, actually, of my life, this kind of you know, existential despair and no meaning to anything and nothing to look forward to give life meaning. And it was in that state that I was walking in nature early one morning. That was the only way I could find solace in those days, kind of lost in my thought in a beautiful spot of nature. And I was walking in the like low pine woods behind the sand dunes on Cape Cod when I received the most spectacular grace of my life. From one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven dropped, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life as though I had died and was looking back over my life in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything after I died. I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from this all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that it was all true, that everything we did had a moral content that was recorded for all eternity, and that mattered for all eternity. I saw that I would be, after I die, you know, here all my life I was worried about life having no meaning, when nothing could be further from the truth. Every moment has the potential for moral action that will matter for all eternity, and if we take advantage of that moment and do the right thing, we will be very literally rewarded for all eternity for having done that, for having made that choice. And if we let that opportunity slip out of our grasp, in some sense, we'll be kicking ourselves for all eternity. That will be a lost opportunity for all eternity. I saw how foolish I had been, that all my life I had been striving for something, for things that wouldn't matter at all even 100 years from now, you know, after I'm dead, when I could have been working for things that would matter very literally 100 million years from now, that I would be still being rewarded for 100 million years from now. It was as though I had been putting all my energy into playing for Monopoly money when I could have been playing for gold coins. I saw that I had been stupidly selfish all my life. I didn't see in this experience, and maybe I'll talk more about it, in the context of this experience, I did not yet see what was wrong about thinking about things selfishly. So during this experience, the way I saw it at the time was I had been stupidly selfish all my life by working so hard for things that wouldn't matter at all. And if I wanted to be smart and selfish, nothing made sense other than trying to be as great a saint as possible. I saw how wrong I had been all my life. I had lived my life as though I were sort of looking in the rearview mirror, saying, if only that hadn't happened to me, then I would be happy today. If only that hadn't happened to me, then I would be happy today. And that nothing could be further from the truth, that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from the hands of an all-knowing, all-loving God. Not only including those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, that I had thought of as the greatest disasters at the time. And the most astounding single aspect of this experience was coming into the presence of God, realizing that not only did he know me by name, but he had been watching over me, intimately involved in my life from the womb, actually, as though I were the only creature he had ever created. And he had not only been controlling everything that happened to me at every moment of my life, but he had been aware of how I was feeling at every moment, and in some sense, happy at everything that made me happy, and sad at everything that made me sad. And to realize that this God, who was the not only the creator of the universe and the creator of everything that is, but the creator of existence itself, had been watching over me and loving me and knowing me as though I were the reason for all creation, was by far the hugest thing in this experience. Now, I knew, of course, that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God, who was revealing himself to me. What I didn't know was what his name was and what religion to follow.
I couldn't think of him as the God of Judaism, the God of the Old Testament. Now, of course, now I know that it was. But in all fairness, if you read the Old Testament, the picture that emerges of God is of a God far more distant and authoritarian and severe and punishing than this God. The picture that I had, if you read the book of Exodus, when Moses was called up to go up Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments, God told him, before you climb the mountain, build a fence around the base of the mountain to prevent any of the people from coming near the base of the mountain, because if anyone should even touch the base of the mountain while I'm on top, they have to be instantly killed because of the sacrilege. So that was kind of the picture that I had of the Jewish God, or the God of the Old Testament. So I couldn't put this together with Judaism, so I prayed to know who this God was, so I would know what religion to follow. And I remember praying, I was still walking, as a matter of fact. Before I go into that prayer, let me just say, it really was as though a veil dropped between earth and heaven. And I still saw the physical world that I was in, and so I could still walk. But I saw it permeated, and behind it, the spiritual world, which is so much realer and more immediate than the physical world, that what amazed me wasn't seeing the spiritual world. The only thing that amazed me was I could ever have not seen it. It seemed so much realer and more immediate than this physical world. And during this experience, it was inconceivable to me that I should ever lose sight of it. Anyway, so that was a little bit of a digression. But so I prayed on the spot, let me know your name, so I know what religion to follow, to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. And I really, very literally, was praying this. The reason I may talk about more tomorrow, but my parents were Holocaust refugees. I had grown up seeing Christianity and Christ as the great enemy, the cause of the persecution of the Jewish people for 2,000 years. Everything would be fine if it hadn't been for that disaster and so forth. So anyway, I really did pray that, and he respected that prayer. I obviously also wasn't ready to hear that it was Christ. And he didn't tell me his name. But I went back home. The experience faded very slowly. I was in a full state of consciousness for about probably an hour and a half, 2 hours. One of the neatest things, by the way, about that state of consciousness was that I could not have a question in my mind without being given the answer. It was as though I had like a searchlight in my forehead, and any question I posed to myself, anything I looked at sort of theologically, the answer was just presented to me. And that faded over a couple of hours, but I went back home to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I was living at the time, happy for the first time since childhood. I knew it was all true. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was never any reason to be anxious about anything. It was more than I had ever dared hope for, you know, in my most starry-eyed, childish idealism. And let me, by the way, back up and say one of the reasons why it's a pleasure to speak to Catholic audiences is because the one advantage that a non-Catholic has, and probably the only advantage that a non-Catholic has, is that you Catholics too often don't realize what you have.
Amen.
Growing up, I would have given my right arm to know the answers to the questions. Who are we? Where were we? You know, why were we created? Who is God? You know, what's God want from us? What awaits us after I die? And so forth. And which you have all those answers in the Penny Catechism. I was dying just to know a few of those answers. Parallel which always comes to my mind is, you know, we grow up in the United States, we have indoor plumbing, we have electricity, you walk in a dark room, you just touch a button on the wall and you get light, and we don't even think about it. But you take an African tribesman who's lived in the bush all his life and bring him to this country, and he'll spend the first 6 months in amazement that all he has to do is turn a knob to get clean water. You know, he doesn't have to walk 2 miles to a stream. And all he has to do is touch a button to get light. He doesn't have to rub two sticks together. And that's the situation that cradle Catholics are in. It's too easy not to be aware that you have what everybody else in the world is dying for. And not only do you have it, but we see it all around us. I mean, you know, God forbid, open a newspaper or turn on the news or something, and you have all these people, I mean, one of the Kennedy wives, right, just killed herself and stuff. Everybody is in agony, they're in misery, they're killing themselves, they're taking drugs, because they have a hole inside to which you have the answer. And not only are you very fortunate to have the answer, but you're very unfortunate in another way, which is we're all going to die, and we're all going to actually review our lives in the presence of Jesus. And we're going to see everything that happened in our lives, including, do you remember when you were sitting on the airplane next to that person, and you were saying the rosary, and they kind of like looked over curiously, but you didn't want to say anything because you didn't want to seem foolish? Well, you were the one person I sent to them, you know, to give them a chance to let them know about me, to let them know about the Blessed Virgin Mary, to let them know about the truths of life and death and God and so forth. And we're going to be held to account. You know, it's just like, if Jesus said, right? I mean, if you're very rich, look at Lazarus and the rich man, right? You know, he's dining on delicacies every day, and this poor man is starving to death at his door. He's held accountable for not having shared the wealth with him. Well, as Catholics, we're going to be held accountable for not sharing the wealth, which is a lot more valuable than the rich foods that Divas was eating at his table. Okay, because they are the means of salvation, and we have them, and we are accountable to share them at every opportunity as much as we can. Anyway, where was I? So I came back to Cambridge. I was happy for the first time since childhood. I knew it was all true. I could not pay attention to Harvard Business School anymore. I mean, it didn't seem to be all that important to teach Harvard MBAs how to make a little bit more money. And I kind of lost interest. All I wanted to do was pursue this experience and know who this God was and do what he wanted. And I didn't know who he was. And this has been a mystical experience. So what do you do if you have a mystical experience and you want to find out more about it? You go find a mystic to talk to, which wasn't a very prudent thing to do in Cambridge in the 1980s. In fact, it's never a very prudent thing to do. And I found this self-styled mystic to talk to. He was actually a fallen away Catholic, and made an appointment to see him, hoping he could shed some light on this experience. Went over to his apartment, and he was into all his Hindu meditation and horrible New Age occultism stuff. And he filled my head with, you know, all these crazy ideas. But one good thing happened when I was over there, which was at one point he went in the kitchen to make us some tea. And I was left alone in the living room, and he had a coffee table book on his coffee table, this big picture book, which is called something like The 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times. And while he's in the kitchen, I'm leafing through this book, and my eyes fall on a page dedicated to the miracle of Fatima. And I'm reading about the miracle of Fatima. I had never heard about it. And it's just a one-page description, and Bob comes back from the kitchen with the tea, and I point to the page, and I say, "Is this true? Did this really happen?" And he says, "Yes." And then my next question is, "Has anyone else ever heard about this?" Now, here I was almost 30. I had probably spent about 24 years in school, and nobody had ever told me about the miracle of Fatima. When I read this, my initial reaction was furious indignation. How could they have kept this secret from me? All those years going to Jewish religious education, my question to my teachers was always, why did God perform miracles in the days of the Old Testament and then stop performing them? And they never had an answer for that. I felt that my whole life would have been different if I knew that miracles were still happening. Well, miracles still are happening, and we as Catholics know about those miracles, and it is again incumbent on us to let other people know about those miracles. Nobody had told me about the miracle of Fatima. We're living in this pseudoscientific age, as I mentioned. Everybody wants proof. Everybody wants evidence. They don't just want some subjective experience. I think that's one of the reasons God has given us all of this evidentiary scientific proof in our age, is precisely because it's the appropriate means of evangelization to the world today. We have the Shroud of Turin, which is totally inexplicable by natural means, and in all of the science of 2012, you know, if every scientist in the world got together, they couldn't duplicate the Shroud of Turin even today, much less in the Middle Ages. You know, we have the Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is scientifically inexplicable. We have the medical healings. We have the apparitions of Mary going on today. and so forth and so on. We have plenty of evidence that there are very appropriate means of evangelization. Anyway, I was furious. I read this story of the miracle of Fatima. I left that guy's apartment with all kinds of bad stuff about occultism, but with the story of the miracle of Fatima in the back of my head, kind of seed planted in my ear that I couldn't quite get rid of. So anyway, so then I spend the next year, every night before going to sleep, saying a short prayer I had made up to learn the name of my Lord and Master and God, who had revealed himself to me in that earlier experience. And a year to the day after that first experience, I went to sleep. I know it was exactly a year to the day because I remember before going to sleep praying a prayer of thanksgiving for what had happened a year earlier. I went to sleep. I felt as though I were woken by a hand gently on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And when I found myself in her presence, I was just, the most overwhelming aspect was just the purity and the intensity of the love which flowed from her was a state of ecstasy greater than I ever imagined could exist. And when I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately. The first word she said to me was she offered to answer any questions that I had for her. Now, all I wanted to do, as I said, was somehow honor her appropriately. So the first thing that crossed my mind was, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. But I didn't. So when she offered to answer any questions I had for her, I kind of wanted to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary. But I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it. So the first question I asked her was, what's your favorite prayer to you, as a way of, kind of an indirect way of getting her to teach me. Well, her initial response was a little bit coy. It was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little bit pushy. Maybe that's because I'm a New York Jew and maybe not. But I said, but you must love some prayers to you more than others. And she relented and she recited a prayer to me, but it was in Portuguese and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember the first few syllables phonetically, and the next morning when I woke up, I wrote them down phonetically. And later, when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all of the Marian prayers in Portuguese. And to the best of my ability, I identified that prayer later as, O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us, have recourse to thee. I knew that when she said it in Portuguese, it was in part as a reflection of a certain childlike Marian devotion and faith in Mary that the Portuguese people have still held on to more than many others. Now I can't help wondering whether it has something to do with the miracle of Fatima and the role that that story played in ripening me to this point, so to speak. I asked her about four or five other questions. I'll mention maybe a couple of others now. Let me digress and say, the most powerful single part of this experience, as I said, was simply being in her presence and feeling the love that flowed from her, which did raise my soul to a state of ecstasy that I'm sure is the joy of heaven and is very related to the joy of heaven in itself. And however beautiful she was to look at, even more beautiful and moving was the sound of her voice, which was carried with it the essence of music without it actually being singing. It was as though whatever makes music music totally permeated her voice and flowed through me and lifted up my soul into ecstasy. So I asked her a couple of more questions. I'll mention maybe two or three now. It's a Marian conference, right? One of the questions I asked her, again, out of the desire to know how to honor her appropriately, was I asked her, I kind of just stammered out, how can it be? How is it possible? How can it be that you're so magnificent, that you're so exalted, that you're so glorious? How can it be? And she just looked down at me almost pityingly and shook her head gently. And she said, oh no, you don't understand. You don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything. And by now, of course, I had figured out that this is Christianity and having Christ in that earlier experience, and I'd better get up to speed about Christianity really quick. And all my life I had heard the expression the Holy Spirit, although I did not know what it meant, and I didn't even know that it referred to a person. So I apologize for the way I phrased this question, but it's really what I said. I said, what's this business about the Holy Spirit? And her response was to look upwards with an expression just melting with love and say, he's his gaze. And then a number of years later when I told this story to some seminarian friends of mine, they pointed out that St. Thomas Aquinas had called the Holy Spirit the look of love that passes between the Father and the Son. So I'll just mention one other of the questions and answers, I guess, now, which was, again, out of a desire to honor her somehow, I asked her what title she liked best for herself. And she said, I am the beloved daughter of the Father, mother of the Son, and spouse of the Spirit. Now let me just say that before I had this experience, first of all, I know now it was a dream in the sense that my body was asleep in bed. If there was a camera in the room, it would have shown my body in bed. I experienced it as though I were awake. My memory is as though it was a waking experience. I remember the feeling of standing there weighing different questions in my mind. What about this one? What about that one? No, that's stupid. Yes, I'll ask this one. So my subjective experience was of a waking experience, but I know that it was actually in the context that my body was asleep at the time. The next morning, when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ in the earlier experience. I knew that I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely a Christian as possible. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic was. But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and I knew who Christ was. There wasn't much I could do other than open a local phone book and find a local church to go to, which was a Protestant church. As soon as I got to know the pastor a little bit, I kind of shyly asked him, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And when he answered without the respect that I knew was due her, I just said to myself, this is no place for me, I'm out of here. And the other thing that was happening was I was spending all my free time at Marian shrines just to walk the grounds and to feel the presence of Mary and to kind of commune with her. There was not far from my house a shrine to Our Lady of La Salette. I don't know how many of you know that apparition. It's a church-approved apparition in 1846 in the French Alps where the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to a couple of shepherd children, a little boy and a little girl, and gave them a message. It was a one-time apparition. It was church-approved. And there was a shrine, a little model of that shrine not far off from my house, and I was driving up there 3 or 4 times a week just to walk the grounds and to feel her presence and so forth. I'll skip forward a little bit because it's a Marian conference. I want to touch on a couple of the Marian aspects of this experience. So the next winter, I was still, by the way, anti-Christian. I know that's hard to say, and still anti-Catholic. But the next winter, I was in the French Alps on a ski trip. And it rained for a couple of days. And the skiing got pretty boring in the rain, so I decided to get in my car and drive to the original La Salette, which wasn't too far from there on the map, because I figured it would be a nice, quiet place away from the noise of the ski area. I could meditate and commune and stuff. I was still far from being, I know it sounds funny, hard to explain, but far from thinking of myself as sympathetic to Christianity at the time. But anyway, so I got in my rental car and I drove there. Well, because of the mountains, it ended up taking all day. It wasn't 2 hours. It was about 6 hours to get there. I got there as evening was falling. It was twilight. The place is incredibly beautiful. It's about 15 miles from the nearest village, way high in the French Alps, way above tree line. You know, you're winding back and forth, climbing the mountain higher and higher past these stone cliffs. And, you know, these snow-covered hollows and stuff, and you get to the final hollow at the top of the mountain, and there, nestled, you know, in the twilight, and the snow was blue, and the sky was pink, was this huge basilica, which is built at the spot of the apparition. And I pull in there, and I see a sign saying reception, and I thought to myself, oh, great, you know, maybe people can actually stay here. Of course, I won't be able to stay here because I'm Jewish, but I might as well ask. So I asked, you know, at the reception, you know, can I spend the night here? And they said, of course. And I was like, really, amazed. As a little aside, I've been thrown out a few hostels in Israel now because I'm not Jewish, so I'm not allowed to stay in them. So it took a big brouhaha. But anyway, it's just, different. So I figured I'd stay there that night and leave the next morning. Well, a blizzard came in that night. That rain, which was rain at the place where I had the snow there. The roads were impassable. I ended up getting stuck there for the rest of the whole ski trip through a number of mishaps. So I spent about the last 9 days of the ski trip stuck at La Salette. Now, I'll tell a couple of little stories that went on there because it's a Marian shrine and Mary appeared there. One of them is the whole time there, I was not awake probably more than 4 or 5 hours a day. I would try to get up in the morning, I would go to breakfast, take a walk, just be overwhelmed with sleep and have to take a nap till lunch, force myself up, eat, overwhelmed with sleep to a nap. I was having these beautiful, sweet dreams where I think that the Blessed Virgin Mary was in the background. But I was pretty disgusted with myself to spend my whole time there sleeping. So one afternoon I decided this is enough, I'm going to force myself up. So, I kind of forced myself half awake and I kind of tried to prop myself up in bed and prop myself up at 45 degrees against the pillows. I'm going to get up and I'm up at 45 degrees and then bang, I fall back asleep. And I fall into this dream. And in this dream, this dream takes place in a service station. And there's a car up on the lift, and there are 3 mechanics working at each of the 4 wheels, and the shop steward supervising the work, right? I'm the car up on the lift. The shop steward is the Blessed Virgin Mary. The car is trying to get down off the lift, and Mary is saying, "What are you doing? Can't you see they aren't finished yet?" So that was kind of my message about what was going on, that a lot of healing was going on while I was there sleeping. And then finally, when I am able to leave La Salette just in time to catch my flight back home, I spent last night at on the couch of a friend's apartment in Geneva before the plane the next morning. And before going to sleep, I say a prayer, which is really a whine. And I say, "God, I can't believe you did this to me." I go halfway around the world to go skiing. It would have been the best skiing of my life, right? Because 3 feet of snow was falling every day. And I couldn't go skiing. I was stuck at La Salette. So I'm praying to God, "I can't believe you do this to me. The best skiing of my life. And you don't let me go skiing. You keep me stuck at La Salette, So I go to sleep in this state. And I wake into this dream. And in this dream, I'm confronted by this man whose life, he reminds me of like a very serious high school science professor who seems severe, but all the kids knew that he really loved them more than anybody else. And he just kind of drills me with his eyes and he says, "You can go skiing or you can work for the second coming. It's your choice, which you choose." So anyway, so that's, that is kind of it, I guess. That is kind of the story of how I got here. There are lots of more. I'll mention one other Marian thing, I guess. I still wanted to find out. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. I had met this very devout Catholic woman at La Salette Shrine in France. She calls me up when I'm back in the United States and says that a friend of hers suggested that it would be good if I got in touch with the Carthusians. Do you know who the Carthusians are? You know that movie, In the Great Silence? The Carthusians are the most strictly contemplative order in the church. And I say, why? And she explains to me, and I say to myself, oh, this is great, because I have this mystical experience. I want to find out more about the truth behind this mystical experience. If anybody knows about mystical experiences, it must be these Carthusians, right? Because they'd go nuts if they weren't having mystical experiences. So I call this Carthusian monastery in France. I don't know anything about them, right? Somebody answers the phone. I say, can I come and visit? And the guy says, no, that's impossible. We're strictly cloistered. We don't receive visitors and so forth. And but then he says, tell me a little bit about yourself. So I start telling him about myself. And I can tell he's wavering. So I said, should I send you a letter? How about if I send you a letter? It's a good idea to send me a letter. So I sent him a letter about myself. And he immediately writes back saying, anytime you want, you're welcome. Well, what I didn't know is that the one exception the Carthusians have to being strictly cloistered and closed is if they think it's a potential vocation, right? And the monk who answered the phone happened to be the prior, so he happened to be the one person who would have authority to do this. So I go over there. I'm still anti-Catholic when I go to that monastery. But I'm with the monks. They get up. They break sleep. They never sleep for more than 3 hours, right? They sleep from about 8:30 to 11:30. Then they go into the chapel and they recite matins until about 3 a.m. from midnight to 2:30, depends on the day. And then they go back to sleep for 3 or 4 hours, and then they have mass and so forth. I'm with them for a week. About three things happen while I'm there. One is, here they have an incredibly severe life. They eat one meal a day. They live in solitary confinement. They don't talk to each other. They don't have much in the way of heat. They're only allowed to bathe once a week. I mean, it's a very severe penitential life. I would have expected them to be bitter and hard and, you know, grumpy. And instead, they're joyful like kindergarten kids, you know, and they have this grin on their face and they're kind of like happy children. And I could feel that the counterbalance to the severity of their life was the presence of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I could feel how, rather than being this sterile, all-male environment, it was really, you know, totally leavened, you know, with femininity, you know, with maternal love, with and also probably in some sense romantic love from the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I could feel how, in some way that I couldn't describe, the spirit of the Catholic Church is Mary. I'm not speaking theologically, so, you know, but somehow the heart and warmth and heart and spirit warming the Catholic Church is the spirit of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And so, so anything but being a sterile environment. And a couple of other things that happened, I would join them in their prayers, and, you know, we'd be in these choir stalls at 2 a.m., and they'd be chanting the Psalms, you know, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, should I forget you? Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth," and so forth. And I'm looking around at all these monks, and I'm saying to myself, these guys are wannabe Jews. So rather than thinking that the Catholic Church hates the Jews, which is what I always thought, you know, I realized that these guys, you know, in some sense, they identified so strongly with Judaism that it was as though they wished they were Jews. And then finally, I'm out in the fields one day working, and this elderly monk shuffles out to me to talk, right, because they're not allowed to talk, so sometimes they like to cheat if they have an opportunity. So he kind of shuffles out to me, and he says, "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" I say, "No, go ahead." And he says, "Well, if you don't mind me asking, you're not Catholic, are you? Because we noticed you weren't taking communion." And I said, "No, that's right, I'm not Catholic." And he said, "Well, if you don't mind me asking, then, what are you?" And I said, "I'm Jewish." And he said, "Oh, that's a relief. We were all afraid you were Protestant." So you can see the transformation that kind of took place during this stay. You can see all these, like, threads woven together. So by the time I left there, I was much more sympathetic to the Catholic Church. I understood that we're not the enemy, but as John Paul II said, you know, the elder brothers in the faith and so forth. And when I got back, I started looking for a priest to baptize me and so forth. Now, I will just close with saying one thing. When I did become a Catholic, when I did enter the church, all of these cradle Catholics would come up to me and kind of throw open their arms wide and say, you know, "Welcome to our church." And I couldn't help thinking they had it backwards. If the Catholic faith is true, it should be me opening my arms and saying, "Welcome to our church," because if the Catholic faith is true, it's nothing but the continuation of Judaism after the coming of the Jewish Messiah. That all of Judaism was about changing the relationship between God and man through the incarnation of the second person of the Most Holy Trinity as a man, with the intention always being that special relationship that God had restricted to the Jews for the purpose of bringing about the incarnation would be opened up to all of humanity through faith in Jesus and the sacraments of the Catholic Church when the incarnation took place. So that's going to be kind of the theme of my talk tomorrow. So thank you very much, and you don't have to take out the book. Thank you.
I better stop. Thanks.